From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nick Hanauer is super rich, deals in billions, an entrepreneur and investor. He's the capitalist dream, and he knows it. But the dream is in trouble in America, says Hanauer. The middle class is collapsing. The system doesn't work without it. If we don't smartly rebalance things, and soon, he says, the pitchforks are coming out. There will be upheaval. This hour On Point, Nick Hanauer tells his fellow super rich to wake up and smell the coffee before it's too late. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this entrepreneur, super rich American right? Are things too far out of whack? Is that alarmist? And what's the right fix? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Seattle is Nick Hanauer, entrepreneur and co-founder of the Seattle-based venture capital firm Second Avenue Partners, the first non-family investor in Amazon. He's started more than 30 companies, sold just one of them to Microsoft for $6.4 billion in cash. His recent essay in Politico magazine, the latest in a series of such salvos, is headlined, "The Pitchforks Are Coming for Us Plutocrats." You can find a link to that essay and more at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Hanauer, welcome to On Point. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Can you just establish your capitalist bona fides with us here? Is it true that you were the first non-family investor in Amazon?
I was. I was extraordinarily fortunate to have a very early interest in the internet for a variety of reasons, and even more fortunate to have a friend who agreed with me that it was going to be a big deal, and that was Jeff Bezos. And so Jeff was living in New York at the time, but ended up packing up his stuff and sending it across the country to my house and driving across the country and starting Amazon here in Seattle. And so I got to help from the very earliest days and essentially be his first investor and help him raise the first round of financing and you know, obviously benefited from that, but also got a very early look at the internet and used that perspective to start a bunch of other internet-based companies, mm-hmm. principally a company called Aquantive, but many, many others. So,
you had some money to invest with Jeff Bezos, in part because you came from a family that's been in business for a long time, a successful betting business.
Yeah. Again, very fortunately, I grew up in a family business, which was very, very small when I was young, but mm-hmm. My brother and I, my dad and others built it up into what is now a pretty big company, about a $300 million company called Pacific Coast Feather Company that manufactures bed pillows and down comforters.
Are you still involved there? You're still head of the company?
Uh-huh. I'm co-chairman of the board. Uh-huh. I'm not the CEO.
Okay.
We have an outsider who runs the company. But
uh-huh.
But there's that and literally dozens of other companies across a range of industries. Robotics, internet, software, medical services, finance and banking, you know, a really broad range of companies doing a lot of very interesting things.
You wrote for Politico and others that you've founded, co-founded, funded more than 30 companies, including,
yes.
I guess, the Amazon and there's the $6.4 billion. Congrats to sales to Microsoft of Aquantive.
Yeah, that was Aquantive turned into what was essentially the largest independent internet advertising company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very successful company that we sold to Microsoft in 2007.
You're not shy in this essay, I guess, to bond and sort of establish your connection to other very rich Americans.
Yeah.
About the fact that this has enabled a very rich lifestyle for you. Multiple homes, the plane, the yacht, the works.
And I do have, you know, one of those very crazy lifestyles. There's no doubt about it.
Lots crazy as in super rich and not unfamiliar to other Americans in that class of wealth.
I mean, there's a you know, 1/10 or 1/100th of a percent of us who live like that. And you know, I won't lie. It's awesome. but you know, the broader point is that, you know, it's all going to come crashing down if we don't find a way to include the rest of our fellow citizens in the economy.
Are you rejecting capitalism, Nick?
No. On the contrary, my view is that capitalism is the greatest social technology ever invented for creating human prosperity. But capitalism can be managed to benefit the few in the near term or the many in the long term. And the role of democracy is to drag it towards the latter. I think our capitalist system is certainly a pretty good system. And the lesson of the 20th century largely was that capitalism works and communism doesn't. But capitalism, comes in as many flavors as pie, and some pie tastes good and some pie tastes terrible. And our job as a democracy is to choose a flavor that that will work well and be sustainable and generate prosperity for all citizens rather than concentrating power and wealth at the very tippy top, isn't sustainable.
And you're saying that's exactly what has happened in spades lately. We saw new numbers out last week from the Census Department saying inequality higher than ever. I mean, this is a pretty hot essay. You write, the problem isn't that we have inequality. You say some inequality is intrinsic to any high-functioning capitalist economy, obviously true. You write, the problem is that inequality as it is at historically high levels and getting worse every day. You say our country is rapidly becoming less a capitalist society and more a feudal society. That's provocative. Mm-hmm. And you say, unless our policies change dramatically, the middle class will disappear and we'll be back to late 18th century France before the revolution. Implication yes. being there that we tempt revolution, and it's more than an implication. You're writing that you see pitchforks coming, i.e. upheaval, maybe in the streets.
Yes. And look, I mean, to be honest, I wrote this somewhat tongue-in-cheek. I do not keep my jet fueled at the airport ready to flee the country because I fear unrest at any moment. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are stark and I think incontrovertible. In 1980, when Reagan was elected, the top 1% shared about 8% of national income, while the bottom 50% of Americans shared about 18. Fast forward to today, the top 1% now share almost three times as much, in the low 20s as a percent of national income. And the bottom 50%, their share has shrunk to 12 or 13. If you simply assume the trend will continue over the next 30 years, although I believe it's accelerating, in another 30 years, the top 1% will share 35% or so of national income, but the bottom 50% will share just 6. I think that kind of split is likely to destroy the economy, but to say nothing of the democracy. I think the whole nation is watching what is unfolding in Ferguson, Missouri today. And I absolutely believe that is kind of what I'm talking about. I mean, at the core, this conflagration in Ferguson is about people who have been disenfranchised economically, politically, and socially, and the anger and disaffection that comes from that. And I just don't think that it makes any sense for anyone, particularly people like me, to engineer policies that accentuate and extend that gap. I just think it's incredibly short-sighted.
Listeners, here's what Nick Hanauer writes to his fellow super-rich plutocrats, as he says. He writes, if we don't do something to fix the glaring inequities in this economy, the pitchforks are going to come for us, i.e. super-rich. He says, no society can sustain this kind of rising inequality. In fact, there's no example in human history, Hanauer writes, where wealth accumulated like this and the pitchforks didn't eventually come out. You show me a highly unequal society, and I will show you a police state or an uprising. There are no counterexamples, none. It's not if, it's when. You know, Americans have had a steady state, more or less steady state civic formula for so long, Nick, that I think many are kind of immune to that kind of thinking. That happens in other countries. That happens in France at the time of the revolution. It happens elsewhere. I think a lot of people just feel in their gut, that doesn't happen here.
Well, I hope they're right. But, you know, surely there's a reason to build an economy that works for everyone, which extends beyond making life safe and secure for the top 1/100th of 1% of Americans. So, you know, even if you don't fear and sympathize with people like me, surely there are good reasons for building an economy that more successfully includes more people. And let me just explain why that is. Capitalism is the greatest technology ever invented to create prosperity, but and people are right who agree that it is a powerful force for good. Mm-hmm. But people massively misunderstand why and how it works. Capitalism does not create value by efficiently allocating existing resources. Capitalism creates value in human societies by effectively creating new solutions to human problems. That's what prosperity is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with zillionaire entrepreneur Nick Hanauer, who says American inequality has now gone too far, that if we don't fix the middle class, the whole thing could fall down, blow up. Headline on his big political magazine piece is, it's a memo to other super rich. He says, the pitchforks are coming for us plutocrats. Plutocrat or not, what do you think? Is he right? Are the rich, the super rich, now tempting class warfare, upheaval? What would that look like in America? And do Hanauer's fears sound overblown or right on? Are things already starting to come apart? What do we do about it? Nick Hanauer joins us from Seattle, entrepreneur, venture capitalist, one of the first investors in Amazon.com, and much more. Nick, you write that your fellow super rich, no small number of them, have looked at you in the aftermath of you talking and publishing this and looked at you, have told you to your face that you're completely bonkers. Describe that reaction.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that you know, a lot of people don't want to believe that the concentration of wealth at the top is a bad thing. And in fact, you know, the sort of prevailing economic orthodoxy rooted in this sort of mid-20th century understanding of how these systems work, is this, you know, is fundamentally the, you know, the trickle-down idea that rich guys like me are job creators, and the more money we have, the more jobs we create, and the better, and therefore the better off everyone else is.
We've heard a lot of that.
Absolutely. And that turns out to be just absolutely categorically not true. That's either a mistake or a lie. Jobs, the economy is best understood as an ecosystem, and jobs are the consequence of a feedback loop between customers and businesses. Which is why the fundamental law of capitalism is when workers have more money, businesses have more customers and need more workers. But, you know, lots and lots of folks at the tippy top would prefer to believe that sort of latter explanation is not true. You know, the efficient market hypothesis, which is sort of the dominant sort of orthodox economic view, is an incredibly sort of emotionally useful frame for very rich people, because if markets are perfectly efficient, then the rich deserve to be rich and the poor deserve to be poor. And that is something that feels really, really awesome to believe if you are very, very rich. It just turns out not to be true, that markets aren't efficient at all. They are effective if well managed. This is not to say that entrepreneurs don't add enormous amounts of value and prosperity in economies. That's what we do. But what we don't do is create jobs. What we do is create new solutions to human problems, which is the foundation of all prosperity.
Your fellow super rich at the yacht club, though, might say, Nick, what are you talking about? You know, our wealth has grown and grown and grown. The middle class is not doing so well. We can see that. But for you and people in that sphere, where's the evidence that it's bad for them? They've only become more wealthy.
Yeah, and you know, some people are not very empathetic and are not connected to the lives of of, you know, the median family.
But your first argument here is not about empathy. It's about what works and what doesn't. The argument you're making is that there's breakdown coming here. But your fellow super rich are getting richer. It may not look like breakdown to them.
Well, that's not true. And to be honest, Tom, when I first started talking about economic inequality and the connection to growth and prosperity 5 or 6 years ago, my peers tended to get incredibly angry and incredibly defensive and felt like that was not a legitimate part of the civic discourse, that any talk of economic inequality was essentially class warfare and off limits in polite society. Yeah. But that has radically changed over the last 5 years. And I think you would have to go, you would have to from Seattle fly all the way to Texas probably to find an intelligent, thoughtful, wealthy person who does not at least agree that rising economic inequality is an issue that the nation needs to confront and that if it continues to get worse, that's going to be a bad thing for everybody. Now, what to do about it is a very different thing, and people have different views. Yep. And rich guys like me tend to get much squirrelier when it comes to talking about the trade-offs that may be necessary to actually fix this problem. But virtually all of my peers, the people I talk to, agree with me today that economic inequality is a problem and a dead end for a capitalist economy because they quite clearly see that if their customers have no money, their businesses will have no customers, right? It's not very complicated. Yeah. So
I want to stick with this for one second, though, because I think a lot of people look out and wonder why this hasn't been more self-repairing. You know, some of the things you're observing seem kind of obvious, and yet here we go on. You talk in your essay about the super rich living in our gated bubble worlds. You say to them, to folks, you know, not aware, you are living in a dream world. You write, revolutions like bankruptcies come gradually and then suddenly. One day somebody sets himself on fire, then thousands of people are in the streets, and before you know it, the country is burning, and then there's no time for us to get to the airport and jump on our Gulfstream 5s and fly to New Zealand. Is that attitude out there somewhere, anywhere? I mean, are people like, you know, have runaway islands on Tahiti where they'll go when it hits the fan?
You mean do rich people think through what their escape route is?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, sure they do. Absolutely. But I don't think, middle class people think about what their escape route is too, right? I mean, everybody
disruption. But for a lot of middle class people, there isn't one. A lot of middle class people, middle class people just need this country to work need to have faith that we're all in on that project.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the most corrosive parts about high levels of economic inequality is the way in which it stretches the society apart. You know, if you live in a gated community, if you fly in your own jet, if you only vacation with people who are like you, if you send your children to private schools only other affluent people send your kids to their kids to, then you become disconnected from the lived experience of people, sort of normal people. And that disconnection breeds a lack of sympathy and over time contempt. And that is extremely dangerous and extremely corrosive. And I think that is a good reason why you want to moderate this economic inequality. You want to have a society where everybody feels like they have a stake in the same thing. And this is why things like Ferguson are so dangerous, because those folks are not enfranchised and they have they may feel like they have very little to lose. And a situation like that in a larger city can get wildly out of control very, very quickly, as we have seen before. The Rodney King riots are not that far, it's not that long ago. Things in many ways were better then.
I understand Ferguson in the sense of, I mean, look at look at the politics, look at the economics. You can understand people's frustration. And then there's a dead young man in the street for hours, and you think, what's going on here? The harder thing sometimes, I was on a flight that came into O'Hare in Chicago, and, you know, stuffed in the back of the shuttle bus, there was a family who were just complaining bitterly because their limo hadn't shown up and they were having to take this shuttle bus. They'd just come in on a private plane. And they clearly very, very affluent, rich. They could not help themselves, even in the company of all of us who were clearly flying, you know, regular airlines. They were just dismayed at this life of people who flew on commercial airlines and how uncomfortable this was and how ridiculous it was. And I thought to myself, you know, there are a lot of people who can't even fly commercial. I mean, and you think this is – and I thought, you know, if this
this
is uncomfortable –
this is
if this is wigging you out, then you've drifted so far off. You don't even know anymore. But you do know – how to get in touch with your senator or congressman to protect your situation. And it worries me that that bubble is thicker than – you say the super rich all understand this now kind of in most places.
No.
But I'm not so sure that the bubble isn't a thick callus.
Yeah, and I emphatically agree with you that the bubble is getting – is what's the metaphor? Thicker or – bigger.
I don't
know what the metaphor is, but it is worrying, and there is simply no doubt that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And you're breeding a generation of people who are detached from, you know, the lives of ordinary Americans. If you make $25 million a year, it is very hard to imagine what life must be like if you earn $25,000 a year. But most people in America earn a lot closer to $25,000 a year than earn $26 million a year.
And yet we don't want this all to drift apart. We all need each other. I mean, when the thing works well, we'll have rich.
Yeah.
And others in the middle class and less will do better, not drift further and further down.
Absolutely. And I just want to make one point about I want to make one foundational point, which is that economic populism, which is this complaining about the rich getting richer and the banks and so on and so forth, which is real and important. But that is economic populism, which is untethered from an affirmative theory of growth, is insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true that the rich are getting richer and it is a bad thing. And it is true that those people on Wall Street have done terrible things to the country and it's a bad thing. But fixing these two things is not a theory of growth. And what I and my collaborators are hard at work in doing is showing people that, in fact, moderating economic inequality isn't bad for the economy. It's actually good for it because, and here's the point, that prosperity, human prosperity, is the accumulation of solutions to human problems. And the thing that does that is including people in the economy, because the more entrepreneurs you have in an economy generating innovation and the more customers you have in that economy supporting that innovation, the faster the rate of that innovation, growth, and prosperity. And this is why moderating economic inequality is actually, over the long term, good for everybody, because the more participation there is in the economy, the better it goes.
Nick, we hear it loud and clear. If I may, let me bring our callers in. That point is fully taken. Rodney in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Rodney, you're on the air.
Yes, I agree a total 100%. No man's an island. You know, when I was in Europe doing my military service, I toured a lot of places where once castles 3,000 years ago, where the common people stormed it because of inequality. And it's been around since the beginning of time. People burnt the castle, killed the elite or the baron or whoever was in charge. And it makes sense. It's basic economics. And I like that part where you said ecosystem. And we're learning now that we need marshes. We need certain things to quiet these storms. At one time, we didn't understand it, but now we understand. It's like the gentleman is saying. I just wanted to say I agree 100%.
Rodney, I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
I appreciate that very much. I mean, Nick, you know, my folks, far as I can tell, they were serfs in the old country. You know, the first one here 350 years ago, whatever, came as an indentured servant. I mean, they came here because this was a place of opportunity for everybody, because there was not an established aristocracy here.
Yes.
Rodney in Stone Mountain says, look, he's been to Europe and seen the castles that came down. But yet, you know, Americans don't feel like we have that risk here. We're different.
Yeah, but you know, people often wonder, ask what you know. There was no revolution in the Depression, right? So why should it happen now? And here's the difference: is that during the Depression, as horrible as things were here in the United States of America, things weren't any better anyplace else on the planet. You had no better option, right? It was, it wasn't like you could go over the border and it was all like, you know, strawberries and cream, right? But here's the thing. 30 years ago, the American middle class was undeniably the most prosperous middle class on planet Earth. And 30 years later today, that is no longer true. That is no longer true. It is indisputable.
Well, you look at per capita income, but I guess that's different than the middle class.
Per capita income is not the measure, right?
I mean, we're way ahead of China because they still have so many poor, but you're saying
the middle
class.
Okay, but we're not way ahead of our country cousins, the Canadians, to the north.
Yeah.
When I grew up, Canada, you know, we looked at Vancouver like this sort of poor cousin when we were in Seattle, and now there is simply no doubt that Vancouver, Canada is a much more dynamic and affluent city than Seattle is. And the median family in Canada is now by every measure more prosperous than the median family in the United States.
And that's right next door.
And that's right next door. The measure of our policies and our economy isn't, is it making you better off year over year? The measure should be, is our economy generating prosperity faster than any other of our, than our competitors are? And the truth is that the median family in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Sweden, Denmark, these families are now doing better than American families.
While we look more banana average. Republic. Stand by. David in Williamsville, New York. David in New York, you're on the air.
Good day, John.
Hi.
Nick and Tom.
Howdy.
I am happily lower middle class, and I don't object to my position in life. I've worked all my life. I do not object to it. What I question, and I love the conversation, is that your guest points out that if the pyramid is supported by the lower, middle, and upper points of the pyramid, namely the upper class, it's getting wobbly, that people don't understand that if the middle class is unable to support both above them and below them.
Yeah. You're afraid the whole thing comes down, David.
Yes, and the other thing I would add is I'm blind. I've worked for years.
Yeah.
And what is really, I don't mind being lower middle class.
Yeah.
I'm very mundane.
Okay.
But I'm also hope that people like Nick, your guest, understand, and he does, that we need to kind of understand that people may have to support them up there.
Yeah, if there's not enough going on, if there's not enough economic health in the middle class, you're worried about the whole pyramid, David, and we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, the point there, we Americans generally aren't greedy, Nick. They just want a well-functioning economy and society, and you're saying, watch out, we're tipping right out of that.
Yeah, and again, I'm not against rich people. I think the economy needs to be designed to emit more rich people, not reward the already rich for being rich.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with zillionaire entrepreneur Nick Hanauer, who says American inequality has now gone too far, that if we don't fix the middle class, the whole thing could come down, maybe blow up. His essay in Politico magazine Memo to My Fellow Zillionaires says, headline, "The pitchforks are coming for us plutocrats." He joins us today from Seattle. This is one of the earliest investors in Amazon.com, been involved in starting about 30 companies himself, sold one of them to Microsoft for $6.4 billion cash. He's got a bunch of homes. He's got a private plane. He's got a yacht. He's got the works. And he's looking at the system and saying, we're out of whack and we need to fix it. Cammy in Charleston, South Carolina. Cammy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. I heard your guest use a line that has been bothering me since middle school, and it is trickle-down economics.
Yeah.
Trickle-down, as I understand it, is simply a concept that essentially a group of speechwriters came up with. When money is flooding up, a trickle here and there is nothing. And
yeah,
this has bothered me for 30 years that an advertising slogan has essentially been used as economic policy.
Cammy, let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Nick, you were not speaking in complimentary terms of it, but
no,
a lot of Americans remember the Reagan years as a time when that sort of boost, you know, that tax cut for the well-to-do came before what we saw as economic revival in this country. And a lot of people say, look at that. There you go.
Yeah, so a couple of things. The first thing is that unfortunately, and I will tell you that, you know, I'm involved enough to know, so I'm very politically engaged.
Okay.
You know, our country is not run by economic policy. It's run by heuristics or rules of thumb, which are derived from economic policy.
What do you mean?
Right? Our elected political leaders are not looking at reams of data to make their decisions about policy. They are using rules of thumb that have been devised over a long period of time. And one of those rules of thumb is that tax cuts for rich people creates growth. Another one is that rich people are job creators, and the more money they have, the more jobs they create. You know, the Ryan budget, Paul Ryan's budget, is the perfect instantiation of those rules of thumb. Massive tax cuts for the rich and the evisceration of the middle class. Why? Because Paul Ryan believes that the people at the top matter and that the people in the bottom and the middle do not matter, right?
And how do you know that? I mean, Paul Ryan wasn't born rich. He still doesn't have a silver spoon. Why should that be true for him? You got a lot of chutzpah
because
say he doesn't care about 90-whatever% of Americans.
No. When I look into Paul Ryan's eyes, I do not see evil. That's not what I said.
That's what it sounds like.
He's not a bad man. I see confusion. I see confusion. And I think that Paul Ryan and John Boehner legitimately believe what they are saying. And there's a good reason for them to legitimately believe what they're saying. And that's because the economics courses that they were taught in college told them that mid-century neoclassical economics, the economic theory which governs our policy and politics today, it created by well-meaning, intelligent people, it basically says that. When John Boehner says, as he often does, if you raise the price of employment, guess what happens? You get less of it, is a rule of thumb which is derived from that body of that intellectual edifice.
Of course, it's also easy to believe that when believing it brings a lot of money into your campaign.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when you harness a mistaken but reasonable theory to self-interest, you end up with a bunch of rules of thumb that benefit a few people and not others. The thing is that trickle-down economics is essentially a set of rules of thumb that our policymakers have used for a long time to generate policy, and in most cases those rules of thumb are just deeply untrue. And some of the reason that people use those rules of thumb is because they are legitimately confused, and some of the reason they use them is because they are advantaged so much by using them, and it's hard to detach. It's hard to sort out where the well-meaning mistake starts or ends and the naked self-interest begins. But
Nick, stand by. People all over the country are listening very closely to you and responding very, very well. Lyle in Metairie, Louisiana. Lyle, you're on the air with Nick Hanauer.
Hi, Tom. I just would like to say that in the early 1900s, when only the rich people could afford an automobile, Henry Ford had an idea that if he produced an automobile that was inexpensive and paid his workers enough money where they could afford to buy one, people could get along, and he paid $5 a day in all of his assembly plants throughout the country, not just in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles.
And that was enough to buy a Model T on in those days.
Oh, well, I think Model T, when my dad bought his, it was about $400.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody got along fine. I just would like to hear some more about Henry Ford, because I think he had the right idea.
Lila, I appreciate your call. Nick, you write about Henry Ford very admiringly.
Yes.
What do you say? And can we still pull that off? Because we've got other listeners writing to us here. Sorry, Nick, those middle-class jobs just aren't available for this country anymore. They're in China. They're gone.
Yeah. Okay. So the Henry Ford example is a marvelous one. Although times are somewhat different, because it would have been easier for Henry Ford because of his market position to do that unilaterally. But we have all sorts of tools available to us through the use of regulation and collective action to do that very thing. The minimum wage is a fantastic example of that. And as you may know, I and my gang of troublemakers out here recently passed a $15 minimum wage in the city of Seattle.
Is Seattle collapsing?
No, oddly, Seattle is not slid into the ocean. And to be clear, Washington State already has the highest minimum wage of any state in the country. We pay $9.32 per hour to all workers versus the $7.25 federal minimum.
Yeah.
But more particularly, we pay $9.32 to tipped workers, and that's 427% more than the $2.13 federal tipped minimum.
Yeah, issue of how we fix it. We had Thomas Piketty on the show a couple months ago when his big book was coming out.
Yes.
I mean, he wants redistribution. He wants a global tax, maybe up to 80% on the wealthy, maybe even on their wealth. And, you know, of course he wants jobs for everybody, but I heard in him some resignation that they're just not there anymore. Are you talking redistribution or?
I think he's dead wrong. I'm a big admirer of Thomas Piketty's work, but I think he gets some of the foundational economics right wrong, because Thomas Piketty, by the way, is as orthodox an economist as there are.
Okay.
His achievement was to put a data set together that shows, undeniably, that in the absence of massive counterforces, market economies concentrate wealth at the top. That is their essential nature. They are multiplicative in nature.
But what about you? You say just raise wages, the minimum wage, but you also point out this isn't Henry Ford's time. We've got competition. You raise those wages, Mitt Romney would tell you, John Boehner would tell you, we're not going to have jobs, Nick.
But it's simply not true. If it was true, then Seattle, Washington would have already slid into the ocean. If it was true that higher wages kill jobs, then it could not also be true that Washington State or Seattle would have a restaurant left, right? Because we're paying 427% more than the federal minimum. And yet the restaurant business in Seattle is booming. Why? Because when restaurants pay restaurant workers enough so that even they can afford to eat in restaurants, that's actually good for the restaurant business, not bad for it. And so there are all sorts of policy options available to us in this country to generate broad prosperity and more growth as a consequence of it.
Anne in Detroit, Michigan, and we'll go to those policies. But Anne in Detroit, thank you very much for calling. You're on, Anne.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to bring up the fact that I feel that our biggest problem in this country is big business taking over more and more, not only with all the overseas manufacturing, but now the new tax laws that allow big business to move their headquarters overseas and not have to pay the taxes that they should, and small people end up paying them. And as well, my family owned a business in Detroit for 76 years, and with business improvement districts, which is something like Times Square, and all the land developers, they forced out smaller and local businesses in almost every city. And we have one developer here who's buying up everything. And to many people's minds, he was part of the lending problem that took people's homes and things that caused the big problems around the country.
Yeah.
And I think the other, just real fast, I want to throw in that the other disappointing part is everybody says that the rich are giving back to charity and things, but the problem is the money doesn't go where it's really needed. It doesn't give people the chance to make their own decisions and get a hand up rather than a handout. And we see that they're really not providing job opportunities for young and old and in all the areas. So.
Sure. I mean, charity is great, but you don't want just charity.
No,
no question. Anne, I'm so glad you called from Detroit. You raise a lot of interesting issues there. I mean, it's hard to know what is going to work here, Nick, and what just becomes a kind of Trojan horse for big business once again. Little guys can't compete. I mean, here we've got Burger King now buying a Canadian donut chain so it no longer has to pay American taxes. I'm telling you, that really, really sours my appetite for anything from Burger. Who wants to eat that? I mean, it's just a giant tax dodge. And who bought all those burgers from them? Americans did.
Right.
And but Ann is skeptical of some programs that come in and say, we're going to rebuild everything, and the little guy ends up on the outside.
Yeah, I think one of the corollaries of trickle-down economics, which is the principal idea being the richer the rich get, the better off everyone will be, is the associated idea, which is the bigger the big get, the better off everyone will be. And that is not true. Concentrated power, wherever it is found, tends to be a bad thing in a variety of ways. And certainly, we need to have policies that make it easier and not harder for small businesses and startup businesses to compete. The fundamental problem with our policies is that they used to be designed to enable to help people become rich, and now what they are is they are basically a reward to rich people for being rich.
So what's your what's your policy suggestion here? What would you do? A couple of three things to help turn this around.
So the first thing is I would raise the minimum wage a lot, and I would
nationally, federally.
And
like
makes far more sense. So I think the 10-10 number is not a bad federal number.
Is that Obama's number?
Yeah, I think that
$10.10.
Yeah, I think it's the Senate number, but whatever it is, from 725 to 1010, I bring up tipped workers to at least 80% of that, if not 100% of that. I would allow cities like Seattle, which are frankly too expensive to live on at 1010, to take the minimum wage higher than that. We must find a way to balance once again the power of workers and owners so that there's a fair split of the value that the enterprise creates, right? Like, so Walmart's a marvelous example. This is a company that earned $27 billion in pre-tax profits last year, but impoverishes workers. And in fact, many states, the biggest group of recipients of food stamps are Walmart workers. This is ludicrous, right? There is no reason why Walmart couldn't take $10 billion of that $27 billion and pay each of its 1 million lowest paid workers $10,000 more a year. And now all of those people won't need food stamps, and all of those people will be able to buy more stuff at Walmart. It makes perfect sense for everybody, but it's not fair to expect Walmart to do that unilaterally. We have to create policy that forces all large retailers to pay their workers enough.
Isn't
so that
part
they
of
can
the problem
survive.
Though that American workers are competing with lower wage workers abroad? How do you fix that? I mean, that's what began to drive these down when Japan started, driving our automobile industry into the ground. We couldn't compete, and it had all kinds of problems, but there was a wage issue. Then China took industry after industry. How do you keep open free trade, which a lot of people support, and raise wages here without just losing?
And it's a very careful balance, but the truth is that most of the jobs that could be outsourced have been. You can't outsource a Walmart job. You cannot outsource a McDonald's job. You cannot outsource the job or automate the job of a person who cleans a hotel room. And the truth is that our economy is mostly generating today low-wage service jobs. Now, here's the thing.
So just raise the wages and share the wealth. It sounds like a kind of
absolutely.
But isn't that a kind of a end run? Isn't that redistribution by another name? If you don't create industries creating a lot of
redistribution.
Well,
what is a redistribution? Look.
Listen, coming up with new technology, new companies that really raise, as you say, productivity and really raise and create new value, make life better. I mean, that's where growth, engines of growth come from. Can we
absolutely.
All? Well,
absolutely.
Well, that's different than just paying your Walmart checkout guy an extra $5 an hour.
But it's simply not true. Look, you take a barista or whatever it is at Starbucks.
Yeah.
This person is not less well trained than the auto worker who made a good middle class living in the 50s.
Well, and but they're not Henry Ford either.
Pardon me?
They're not Henry Ford either.
Well, I mean, but you just take these jobs, these low wage service jobs don't create less value than the middle class manufacturing jobs from former times. The only difference, Tom, is power. The facts are that auto workers had economic power that was delivered through their union, which enabled them to get a fair split of the value that enterprise created.
Hey, Nick, I've only got you for half a minute more. Are your fellow super rich buying this? Because they have the top 1%, as you remind us, has 20% of the national income now. Never mind wealth. If it smells anything like giving up some of that, are they really going to get on board to do this?
You know, a few of them will and many of them won't, but it's up to the other 99.8% of Americans to wake up and start to agitate for policies that make more sense for everyone.
I mean, that's the beauty of democracy. There is power there to be used.
Yes.
If people step up and use it.
Absolutely.
Nick Hanauer, entrepreneur, venture capitalist, zillionaire. His piece, Memo to My Fellow Zillionaires in Political Magazine, is The Pitchforks Are Coming. Nick, hey, what is this about? Are you running for office or is this just...
No, I'm writing books.
Okay.
I'm writing books.
All right. We'll be listening. We'll be reading. Nick Hanauer, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Tom.
Yeah, sure. Terrific having you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm there on Twitter, Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks a lot for joining us today. This is On Point.